Okay, today I'm with Alistair Dan on the Oxfordshire-Gloucestershire border.
Yep.
Thanks very much for agreeing to talk to us today, Alistair. Now, you've just won the Racing Writer of the Year for the fifth time. If I'm correct, the first time was in 1994.
Yes.
What's kept you ahead of the game for so long?
I don't know. I think this one was probably a long service medal. I suppose it's not a question of being ahead of the game, because there are plenty of other very good people at it, but you should get better at something as you do it for a longer time, shouldn't you? And I love doing it. It's as simple as that. I'm paid to pursue a passion. It's the old story. I've never found a better way to put it, but that is the truth. It hardly represents a day's work. Not that I'd like people to think I do nothing, but I couldn't sit in an office 9 till 5. And nobody in an office could have me sitting there 9 to 5.
So it started somewhere. So what was the flame that lit the passion of horse racing for you?
My father, God bless him, Gordon Dan, worked in the city at Lloyd's, insurance brokers or the insurance conglomerate. He'd come from an extremely humble background, didn't really have much choice. What he did after the war, which he fought in for 5 years. He loved his horse racing, and he'd come home on a Friday night. And Saturday, I'd go down and get what was then the Midday Standard, London Standard, which was a pure racing edition, unbelievably, which Midday Standard was out at 8 in the morning. Go and get a copy of that, and he'd look at the form and sit in front of the telly, leaping up and down, shouting and screaming, which wasn't like him at all. And I would, age 4 or 5, be on the arm of his chair, and all dads being heroes to their sons, which he remained through to the age of 88 when he died. I thought, well, it's good enough for dad, it's good enough for me. And I got very interested quite young. And I had my first ever bet in the 1961 Grand National on a horse called Nicholas Silver, who was a very pale grey, a white grey, and it won. And I thought, doddle this, you just pick the white one and you give dad tuppence in old coins and he gives you half a crown or something. So I thought, this is the future.
So was it the gambling or the spectacle?
Well, I wasn't the gambling age 5, no. It was the excitement, actually. Jump racing in particular, my late brother was keen as well and used to keep lots of immaculate records of things. And the three men in the family were all keen. My sister to this day disdains it, but understands that it isn't quite as appalling as she thought. And my mother would have 3 bets a year, and they always won, much to my father's huge annoyance.
Now, I read that you chose York University because you could reach 8 racecourses within 50 minutes. Is that actually true?
It is absolutely true. I remember driving up from living those days on the Kent coast, and I got in my little black Mini and drove, as always, far too fast up to York. Still took a fair time. Walked in to see Professor Atkinson, the philosophy professor, who was a charming man. And he said, why York, Mr. Dan? And I said, well, I get on 8 racecourses in under an hour. And he said, see you in a couple of months' time. That was it. That was the interview.
So you obviously had a massive love for horse racing already by that point. Was there ever a temptation to not even bother with the university and go straight to some aspect?
No. I wanted a degree that, on reflection, of course, I did absolutely nothing at all for 3 years except really go racing. I mean, I used to come down for sort of months racing in January, February with mates down in this neck of the woods and go to... I'd race from what was then the Schweppes meeting, the big handicap hurdle of Ryan Price fame in those days, oh, right through to Charlton and near the university. I think I went to 2 lectures in the last 2 years.
I was going to ask if racing helped or hindered your university education. You've already said
well, I didn't let the university education hinder the racing, put it that way.
Any particular tales you can tell us from those days? Any scrapes at university?
Oh, God, endless. But I mean, I really went to university so little. I lived about 15 miles away, there was lots of student behaviour. And I raced assiduously at York, obviously, back the odd winner. But I mean, I also had my biggest disaster betting when I was 19, when I backed a horse in the Yorkshire Cup at 13 to 8 on, and I had plenty on it. Six runners, and it was fifth of six. And I had done my money for the next 6 weeks or 8 weeks. And I rang Dad a couple of days later. I said, oh, I've made such a balls of this. I've lost all my money, Dad. It's very bad luck. And about a week later, a cheque arrived for some of it. And we're not talking big sums. We're talking big sums for students. And I have never had an odds-on bet under rules since. And that is 43 years ago. And I think it was the cheapest day's punting I ever had. It's a good day. So back to Towar to in the Ebor. I'll never forget. I had 11 quid, I think, which is a biggish bet, at 22 to 1 with one of the Yorkshiremen in the ring. And I went, I disappeared off and had plenty of champagne and tottered down at the end of the day. And he said, I've been waiting for you, the silly bugger had a stupid sum. A silly sum was a silly price. But yeah, I cut a lot of teeth racing in Yorkshire, although really my home county of Kent. I was at Tunbridge School and I went racing at Lingfield a huge amount. And in those days it was called Lovely Lingfield. It was the most picturesque race course in the country, you could almost argue. I mean, fight with Goodwood perhaps, but it was just a paradise race course. And it died in two cuts. One was the 87 Storm, which wiped out all the trees, and the other was the All-Weather, which for all its undoubted qualities, I'm sure, is not a thing of outstanding natural beauty. But it was a fabulous place. And in those days, the big hitters were people like Peter Caslett, the Royal Trainer at Fairlawn, which was near Tunbridge, a huge private house, where one of the Rue brothers was chef. The other Rue brother was chef at the British Embassy in Paris. And at Fairlawn, you'd have the Elizabeth Taylors, the Queen Mothers, and the Old Cowards all down for the weekend. Peter Caslett was a very intimidating, bushy, eyebrowed man, always in a bowler hat, tweed suit, real martinet. Sacked all the staff one day because he found a cigarette end in the yard. And then had to reinstate him in the afternoon. We discovered that it had been dropped by the postman. But he had great horses, and it was fascinating that the roof, one of the, I can't remember, it was Albert or Michel cooked for him, and the other one in the Embassy at Paris. And in, I think, 66 or 7, the brothers went to Caslett and said, we'd like to start a restaurant. And Caslett and his chums raised $6,000, and they opened up, I think, just off Sloane Square. And from day one, it was full of the richest people in England, because they'd all either stayed in the Embassy or stayed at Caslett's. And they paid, I think the Rubens paid them, the backers back within 2 years. It was astonishing, the restaurant trade. And had gone on to be the great culinary revolutionaries of their time. And Rue Jr. is still residing at the Gavroche in Mayfair.
So you were keeping yourself in the best company in those days.
Well, I used to go to the pub called The Chaser near Caslett's Yard. Never been a better racing pub name to combine chasing and having a swift one to follow the beard. And I used to go in the public bar and listen to all the stable staff talking. Well, I was meant to be at school at the time, but I had a good arrangement with a local van hire company who had a contract in Gravesend, and their vans would go back to Tunbridge late at night. And the last van was under instruction to stop at the Chaser and pick this odious little child up. And it cost 50p to get back. That's great. And I also had a house down the hill, great friends of the family, a guy called Dick Howe, who'd been the escape manager at Colditz, would you believe? And he would run me back on Saturday afternoons when I wasn't playing rugby or something silly like that. So I had it all quite well organised. I didn't let school get in, I've never let education get in the way of grace.
Now, you mentioned briefly the bookmakers when you went to collect your bet after, was it £22? Was the betting ring something you really enjoyed, the character?
Yeah, I loved it. It was utterly different. And obviously the southern rings were different to up in Yorkshire and things like that. But it sounds very cliched and slightly rosy spectacle, but it isn't. It was populated with independent characters with a firm idea of running their own business. And obviously they laid money around the ring in those days, all done by Tic Tac. But they took their own view. There was no machine to play with. It was all, of course, blackboards and chalk. And I watched them coming in with those enormous joints and lugging in machinery. And I say to some of the older ones, but you miss your blackboard and chalk, don't you? And they, right, you do. But it was full of characters. And, you know, the Southern Ring, I could name a dozen of them now. Some immaculate figures. They were hard old characters, yeah. But you got to get to know them, but you knew all their faces, and of course you ended up with your favourites. But yeah, you wouldn't cross them.
So when you left university, did you leave with qualifications that got you where you are now, or did you just leave with the experience you
got? God, there's no qualification that got me where I am now. I left with a moderate degree, 2-2 in politics and philosophy, and I went betting for 3 years. And after 2 years, I realised that I wasn't losing money, I was not going to make any. And I got a few people to invest in this venture, there were two of us, and we just, after 3 years, we gave, I suppose, 50% of money back, and said, sorry, we're not good enough.
So when did you first combine your talent for written English with horse racing?
Well, I started work, I think, in 1980, possibly 79, over at Halal Butchers in Battersea, the offices of Raceform, who made the form books. And it was positively Dickensian. High stools, quill pens, wouldn't touched it. You got paid about threepence every 2 months. It was horrendous, but you learnt quite a lot. Editing. It was editing what was then the Racehorn notebook, which was comments from the likes of Walter Glynn, still blissfully going these days. But he got you an NUJ ticket, which allowed them to pay you nothing because they knew that's why you were there, and it allowed you to get a job in Fleet Street, without which no NUJ ticket, membership, no job, because of all the closed shops that operated. And I went racing one day, Saturday, ran into a character who was the racing editor of The Sun, and he said, oh, why don't you come work for us as a casual? I said, oh gosh, yes please. And I started the following Monday, I think. And you used to get, I've never been better off. You used to get 35 quid a shift. The Sun Racing Desk in those days had a full-time staff of about 8 and about 7 casuals, which I mean, it was like a sort of Cecil B. DeMille production. There was no work to do. My main job was to go at lunchtime to the pub, the first edition, at about 1 o'clock and order the drinks. And at about 3:30, 4 o'clock, my job, when they all went back to office, was to get the sandwiches. Really nothing done. I mean, you know, Claude Duval would do his piece for the paper, but that was might be 10 pars. Well, that was a par each for people to sub. It was an absolute racket, I cannot tell you. And you used to get paid in cash, you get a piece of paper, you'd done your sheet, you went up to a sort of Santa Claus in the sky on the fourth floor, he gave you £35. Or if you did an alleged double shift in the summer, which meant sitting around doing the results in Windsor on Monday night, you got £70. I mean, I lived like a Maharaja. A bottle of champagne was only about a fiver in those days. And I did all right, they say.
Okay, Alistair, so cut your teeth. Sounds like you enjoyed yourself working for the Sun.
Yeah, because it was nice to do, and they threw money at you. You couldn't not enjoy it. And then while I was at the Sun, Sporting Life got in touch and said, we are advertising two jobs as sub-editor. It was early 81. Would you apply for one? And I duly did. I went and saw Ozzie Fletcher, who was editor of the Life for a million years, and who lived on his nerves and about 100 cigarettes a day. But it was a good fellow, quite remote, but quite gentle fellow, bit of steel to him, editors tend to. And I went to have an interview with Ozzy, and he sort of asked me a few inane questions, and said, well, can you start the second week of March? And I said, well, I'm terribly sorry, Mr. Fletcher, and I can't, because third week of March is Cheltenham, but I'll start after Cheltenham. And he looked a bit old-fashioned at me, he said, all right, go on.
So that should have been a good qualification.
I wasn't going to miss Cheltenham. I haven't missed a day at the festival since I was 19, I don't think. God knows how I got the time off in those early days, but I managed it.
So was it actually working, going into the office every day?
Yeah. And people will giggle, my colleagues now, because they always say I do absolutely nothing, but for a number of years, a good 10 years, I worked pretty well all hours at the Life and the Weekender and climbing up the ladder, because in those days I entertained hopes of editing the paper one day. And it was a bit like a holiday again, the Life. It was old Fleet Street, you know, plenty of us, and people would have a lunch and might come back, or certainly went out in the evening, might not come back. And it was the days of Hot Metal and the print unions. That was a hard, difficult side. There were some absolute so-and-sos involved there.
Now, I first became aware of you would have been in about 1983, nice to buy the Weekender.
Yes.
And you shared a page with Geoffrey Bernard. And if I remember rightly...
Well, I certainly was in the paper with Geoffrey, yes.
And that's why memory serves. I remember you being, I could be wrong, but on the, you know, and a similar sort of style. Did you spend a lot of time with him?
No, but I did interview him. I was sent to go and see him at the Coach and Horses in Soho and everything. And to try and chat him up into working with the Weekender. And like you said afterwards, he was surprised nobody drowned that afternoon. I had quite a good head for it in those days. But after he'd had 25 lime and vodkas, or vodka lime, whatever else he put in, he came to work for us, yeah. And he was the established wit of the game, and popular, and he was very much in his prime still. I didn't see a lot of him, no, because, you know, he was in Soho all hours of day and night, leaping out of betting shops and beds. He was good at that.
So when did you start frequenting press rooms on racecourse?
Well, it's kind of hard to remember. I suppose I came to notice writing in the Weekend because it was light-hearted, Mickey-taking, slightly different stuff. And it wasn't Bernard, sub-Bernard. He had his way of writing, I had mine. And it was very light-hearted, and people liked it. When I first started frequenting the press, I suppose it must have been by the late 80s, yeah.
And there would have been some big characters.
They were full of enormous characters. In those days, journalists drank on course, there was alcohol in the press boxes. You haven't found that for the last 10 years, thank goodness. And yet there were some massive characters. And of course, all those days, it was phoned through. That was the way it got through. You phoned it through from the race course. And somebody in the office, the copy takers, would take it all down. Excuse me. And the copy takers were legends in themselves. You know, somebody would come on from Anfield on a Saturday just after they'd scored, Liverpool scored a third goal, and the guy in the copy would say, noise in the background, can you get them to shut up a bit? Do you try and get the cops shut up 3-0 up this Saturday afternoon?
I imagine it must have been quite daunting, the press rooms in those days.
On reflection, I think it probably was, because the big beasts of the jungle, you know, they did their own thing and they're not going to pay any attention to some little squit, but I was never treated with anything but encouragement. I mean, getting into the game originally, you know, you used to write to people like Peter Sullivan, Richard Bearline, the great Guardian racing correspondent. You wrote to all those people who just said there are no jobs, but keep trying, and that was... So once you were in. In terms of the press room being daunting, to me, it was just another establishment, and I'd spent all my life up to then fighting establishments. And the Jockey Club were my sort of arch target because I thought they had to go. It took me many years to recognise that they had qualities. I mean, they knew nothing about business, we knew everything about horses. And now we've got people who know nothing about horses and everything about business.
Do you think they'll find a happy medium then?
No. Certainly down the road of racing politics, I used to get very firebrandish about it when I was young. Everyone goes in sort of about a figure, a sort of establishment conservative figure. I've never been either of those things. And I used to sort of kick against any system I could see. Because, of course, I knew everything and nobody else knew at all. It's like that sign people have on their walls, you know, ask a teenager while they're still a teenager and know everything.
So how broadcasting came along?
How did that come along? I did a racing club evening at Cheltenham, and in the audience, it was the first one I'd done, among the audience was Andrew Franklin, one of the great figures in racing over the last few decades, a man who gave life to Channel 4 racing and ran it for 25 years or so. And afterwards he said, oh, McCrick goes away in the autumn, would you like to come review the newspapers? And I said, yeah, I'd love to. Never gave it another moment's thought. This was, I think, probably sort of February, March. Typical Andrew, planning decades ahead. And then I think it must have been August. I was at home, and phone rang, and I was talking about it in the kitchen with the wife, and... I said, you know, I don't think I can be bothered. I'm quite put out. I said, I think it's really me, television, everything, blah blah blah. And put the phone down. But it was all very civil. And Frances, my wife, said, who's that? I said, it was Andrew Franklin, Channel 4, wants me to do a bit on. She never got cross. I mean, had every reason, but she never got cross. She said, you will pick up the phone now, and say you made a mistake. And you love to do it. So I did. And I started doing newspaper reviews. I think starting at Newcastle, Fighting 50, I suppose it was. And I thought it absolutely terrifying. We had hold these bits of paper. And I was shaking with nerves, not as some people probably assume nowadays, the effects of many years of dissipation. But I found it terrifying. But they were just a good bunch to work for and with, in front of camera, behind the camera. Just, it was a joy to work with such enthusiastic, civilized, and it was funny. The whole thing was funny. And yeah, you got them some pair of scrapes doing that as well.
Come on then.
Oh, all sorts of things. There were too many late nights, which are bad when you're starting at 6 in the morning. We'll be up at 5:30 or something. Things like locking yourself out of your hotel room in St. Helens or somewhere at 3 in the morning with no clothes on. And it was a nightmare. It was absolute nightmare. I won't go through the details of how I got back here. But, I don't think I was the only person ever to do that.
I'm sure people would be glad to hear that that's what it was like. So, because for most people, those were the golden years of racing TV, I think, and the chemistry.
I think they had a very strong identity. I think Andrew was a genius at making programmes. He set the agenda that lasts this day for how racing is covered. He made it much more interesting. He could see the interests of the public first and foremost ahead of the television companies themselves. I don't know if it's golden age. I think it was. It certainly wasn't a tarnished one, and I think at its best, it was an enormous amount of fun for the viewer. In those days, the morning line had a very considerable viewership, of which around 40-45% had no interest in racing whatsoever. But it was one of the first times you could sit and watch some semi-intelligent people sitting around taking the mickey out of each other.
Yeah, it's a big characters there, didn't you? Big personalities.
Oh, God, yes, absolutely. You know, the Crickets and Frankhams and Jim McGrath. I mean, I'd know Max. Mac was chief reporter at the Post in 81, at the Life in 81 when I joined. And he was an enormous figure. And I think one of the most underrated figures in British racing in the last two or three decades, because he was a brilliant reporter. He was the only person ever from our game. You know, I win a sort of in-house prize every now and again, but he was reporter of the year for the country, you know, got his award from Mrs. Thatcher and things like that. He did some major stories. Stories came into him. He was already a very high-profile character. And you got in the back of a taxi, and they said, oh, what you doing? The first question was, oh, do you know John McCurrick? I mean, he was more people could name John McCurrick than they could the Home Secretary at the time, or even the Prime Minister. Mind you, not many Home Secretaries look like Mac or sound like him. And he wouldn't pretend to be the force he was, but he had a wonderfully quick, questing mind, and was always thinking two or three steps down the road. And I admired him greatly. I mean, I won't say that he doesn't drive me insane on occasions, and he developed a tendency. He would have walked over his mother's face in hobnailed boots to be in front of a camera by some stage. But don't forget what a crusading force he was for the punter. And of course, he made every programme difficult, because he could just suddenly say anything. And you'd have Frank, you could hear Franklin screaming in his ear, shut up, Mac, shut up, Mac. And he'd just totally ignore it. And then it would all go off. Once he'd come off, why didn't you do it? He was a team player, but he wasn't going to be a sort of nameless midfielder. He wanted the ball to his feet and kick it where he wanted it.
That must have been quite a hair-raising experience for a producer in that live show.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, it is live. Never. I think people are so much better at it these days. I don't have either of the specialist channels because I sit and watch it all day. And there are other things in the world than horse racing. But when you do see it, the knowledge of these people is just unbelievable. I mean, they might not know, who is Lawrence Secretary, but they can tell you what finished sixth and maiden at Pontefract 4 months ago. Not sure it's entirely brilliant talent, but it makes a television thing. There's nothing they don't know.
So did your love of horse racing ever result in you actually getting involved as an owner?
I've had bits and bobs of horses down the years. Shares with Jim Old. Flat horses with Sir Mark Prescott. The first one was called Queen Sigismund, and we bought it at the end of its 2-year-old career. It had plenty of runs and hadn't won anything. And at three, she won. She was second a couple of times, but she won four races in a row, I think. The first off 70 and the last off 65. Now, don't ask me how he did it, because most horses couldn't get up, don't they? But somehow, the more it won, come down a pound every time. And of course, when it got to 65, I said to him, I'm taking this horse away, it's deteriorated, which he always loved. And then we got another one that, following, yeah, we sold that to Coolmore. Well, it went to the sales and Coolmore paid 28 grand for it or something like that. We paid 13 between about six of us. And then we got another one, a 2-year-old, and it didn't run. And then it came out in the autumn and won two in a couple of weeks. And I said, right, Sir Martin, it's great. Let's sell her. Can't sell that, never pass a vet. Never took a sound step in its life. Didn't sold him with it. And then the following year, I think I'm probably allowed to tell the story, it got a bit lost, shall we say, and ran up a sequence of noughts. And you might, if you had inquired of Sir Martin how it was going to run today at Haydock, he might have answered, well, it'll be between 8th and 11th, Mr. Down. And because you wouldn't ask and he wouldn't say that. Anyway, come the day, I think it's a Monday or Tuesday after the Air Gold Cup meeting, Leicester. And there are sort of words in the air that it might run a bit better. So we all go to Leicester and all have our boots on this thing. 20-year-old runner, 6 furlong sprint. Anyway, cut along to she's murdered four lengths by one of Mick Easterby's that he's been stopping even longer than anyone else had. Something had failed to get in the silver cup at Ayr. So, a bit deflating because we really had a bit of a go at our own little level. I think David Ashwell's still paying. So it goes home and I ring Sir Martin evening saying, well, bad luck and blah, blah, blah. And he says, well, she's all right in the morning. She'll go to Nottingham. What? No, she goes to Nottingham tomorrow. She'll be fine. So off she goes to Nottingham. None of us go. We haven't got the bus fare between us and the backer with. Of course, she bolts up. And clearly the plan had been to win two in 24 hours. And I remember ringing George Duffield and saying, I'm sorry, George, you weren't there today. Well done. Thank you very much. I said, the reason we weren't there is we all had our brains on yesterday. And he said, so did I.
Has punting been a big part of your
life? No, I've never been a big punter. I'm a real cucumber sandwich with the crusts off punter compared with youngsters today. I don't think I've ever had more than 300, 400. I think once I had 300, 400 quid in the horse. I mean, I'm a 50 quid, 100 quid punter. You know, I've had lots of children and bills to pay and educations and divorces, well, one. You have to do all that stuff before you know, and we're not merchant bankers or hedge fund managers, you know, we've got Range Rover out the front or money to burn.
Now you can.
Don't get me wrong, I like a bet, particularly over jumps, but it's never been a matter of life and death, and it has always frightened the life out of me. As youngsters coming up in the trade, the sums of money they're betting. But I keep, nowadays when there was such a thing as a format, I use it to keep the door open. I've never spent 10 minutes with those in the format in my life. I'm Gus the Guesser. But after a long time in the game, you can kind of work out what people are up to or what they think their horse is capable of. And you tend to back trainers, really, at the end of the day.
Yeah.
You run into the odd horse, you think, you see it young, like I saw Hardy Eustace young and thought, now that is a proper horse. I suppose, the current lot. I latched on very early to Kalashnikov if he's going to fulfil his. So that was painful when he got beat at Cheltenham, too. But, you know, Dawn Run I was on to very early for various reasons. So those sort of horses, I am a follower over Cliffs, but funnily enough, I can also spot one and be right about it, but desert it too early. But it's either feast or famine. Either follow them over Cliffs or get out too soon. And both are as annoying as each other.
Now, you mentioned Cheltenham several times. That's a massive part of your life.
It is. I'm half an hour from Cheltenham. I have been for 32 years down here. I was captivated by it as a child, watch it in black and white. My mum and dad used to go for a couple of days. They always came back having had a riot. And I've just everything about it. But, you know, I grew up to that O'Sullivan. I was, eight when Arkell departed the scene. So I go all the way back to that early 60s stuff. And Cheltenham, it's just fascinated me from a child. And I first went when I was 19. I had a box, would you believe? I think I'm the only person who was, I think on at the time, on Social Security, who's ever had a box at Cheltenham. And the box was right on the winning post in what used to be the old newsstand, now thankfully gone. And it was a friend's box, a friend of my father's, and they couldn't use it. So Dad said, look, this fella said, would you like it? And I said, yes, please. So it was a box for 12, I suppose. Viewing area out front, corridor, dining bit. Because none of us could afford a square piece of ham for 8 guineas or whatever it was. So I just said to him, bring plenty of booze in your pockets and we'll buy the mixers and things like that. I think we had about 42 people in this box. It was like the Black Hole Calcutta. And in those days, of course, people were drinking riotously. There were various women folk there for other reasons. They were sort of more interested in picking them from the residents of the box and the horses. But I think Willie Wumpkin, we had information Willie Wumpkins would win, which he did at 33, which I ignored. We had a lot of good information came into that box that day. We made money. There were some interesting characters in there, including the man who devised the blueprint and bought us the Olympics in 2012. A lot of bright young people on their way up the ladder. We were all late teens, early 20s. And I think four of them woke up in a siding in Paddington at about 5 a.m. and swore they'd never go to Cheltenham again. It was an absolute riot, and we caused chaos in this box. All the people. We had a large gentleman from Samoa who went on to make a fortune in the computer business. And he was an enthusiastic consumer of what are known as spliffs. And he was known as the large Indian because he was a Samoan sort of fellow. He should have been known as the large Samoan, I'm sure. And he just spent the afternoon standing on the balcony, surveying the scene, which he absolutely adored, smoking these enormous things like sort of First World War siege guns. And the smoke drifted all the way down across the Great and Good and Tweeded. I remember Peter Cundall was in the next box, so I don't suppose he's ever had an experience like it. But it was very much like that. But God, it was fun. And I haven't missed a day since. I've never had a box of my own since.
That sounds pretty memorable. But what would you say the most memorable day of sport at Cheltenham has been for you? And I know that's pretty difficult to pick.
God. Diddly-dum. The most memorable race for me would be Dawn Run's Gold Cup. It had everything. If I had desert island races, I think most of them would be staying chases. Dawn Run's Gold Cup was just an unbelievable piece of theatrical drama. But I was also there for all those Sea Pigeon, Night Nurse, Monksfield renewals. And they were absolutely fabulous. I mean, year after year, people talk about the golden age of hurdling. It was. It absolutely was. Not because they all won three each, like so many have, but because you just did not know which one it was going to be this year. And they were all utterly different horses. Night Nurse, a big chasing type. Monksville, you could train through a polo mint. And Sea Pigeon, this enormous talent, which had to be finessed, and duly was. Those were great years, I think. They'd be famous punting days when you've been right about something for a couple of months, and famous disasters. And the disasters are always better than that. Nobody wants to hear about people making a few quid, but Norton's Coin was a disaster because I'd become convinced in January, I think, that Norton's Coin was a certainty at Charlton for the Mild Mare of Fleet. And I remember, it must have been the sort of 5 day time. I'd never smoked Silvergrass in my life, never heard of it. I wouldn't be able to recognise it, but I was absolutely convinced, because handicaps Cheltenham are my thing, I was absolutely convinced this would win. And I'd been telling everyone from January through to March, this is the one thing you got to back at Cheltenham is Norton's Coin. When the Mild Mare of Fleet. Anyway, come sort of Dex time, I rang Cyril Griffiths, just check horse all right. And he, I'll never forget, he said, oh, it's market day today. He says, and I missed the entry for that Mild Mare of Fleet, so he's going in the Gold Cup. I snapped, thank you, Mr. Griffiths. Good luck, and I swam the phone down. And there were about three or four. I said, that runny Gold Cup. Well, of course, nobody in the back in the Gold Cup. But two out, my great friend, the late Neil Cook, who was also had been in on the other gamble, just turned to me and says, oh, so I really don't think you want to watch this. But one of my oldest chums, who was not a keen racing man, rang me late that night and said, I've just fulfilled a lifetime's ambition. I've been into the, I think it was the White Bear at Shipston, which would have had Cheltenham Week, a couple hundred people in. I bought everybody a drink, because he had backed it, because he'd know the Mild Mare of Fleet from, you know, the Blackwall Tunnel. So a couple of people did have bright touches on the thing, but I wasn't one of them.
I've read somewhere that you would like your ashes scattered at Cheltenham.
Well, if they've got a sort of big enough area to put them, I suppose. Top of the hill where it's all, where you've got that view actually up to the stands, and it's this and then that, and the race is yet to unfold.
So between now and then, if you back the winner of the Derby 100-1, are you going to change at the Tatton Corner?
Good Lord. Can't wash your mouth out with bleach. Certainly not.
Now, arguably, what you're best known for is your writing.
Oh yeah.
Now you can write wonderfully descriptive features that bring a horse race to life, jumps out the page, or you can write pieces that make people laugh out loud, and sometimes both. Now, do you find it as effortless as it seems to the reader?
No, I don't find it effortless. I will sit there sweating or perspiring mildly over the first paragraph for ages. The crucial thing with writing a piece, say from the race course, is a first paragraph that makes people want to read the rest. At least one memorable or amusing paragraph somewhere in the middle, or even, you know, perspective, or, you know, perceptive or piercing paragraph, and a decent finish, because that's the only thing I remember. But it's the opening paragraph that is important. And I was taught something, McCurrick taught me something in 81, 82. And when I heard, and people will hear this and think, well, it can't make any difference at all, but I stuck to this religiously. He said to me, never start an article with the word the. And I never have started an article with the word the. And you do see an awful lot of articles. You go to any newspaper, they start the so-and-so, so-and-so, fine. But it makes you think slightly differently about how to start a piece. And it was, I hate to say it to him, and he denies he ever said it, but he did, that it was one of the best pieces of advice I had, though I didn't realise it at the time, but somebody made me follow it. People get grumpy that I use, quote, long words, as the famous flat trainers always say, oh, stupid long words. Well, if they're long words, you don't understand them. Look the effing things up. If you don't have a dictionary, they have a thing called Google now. Learn a word a day. If I come across a word, I think I've got a list about five or six words on a piece of paper there that I don't know the meaning of, and I will look them up sometime over the next day or two. I probably never use them because I've not used them so far, otherwise I'd know what they meant. But words are amazingly powerful. In the age of the instant with images and everything on tablets and phones, and which is absolutely fine and marvellous, words have a longer resonance, a deeper set of echoes. You remember expressions or words in the way you don't remember a selfie taken at Skegness on holiday.
Okay, now in your job, especially in the horse racing business, people are a lot more accessible, so you've met some wonderful characters, I can imagine.
Oh, gotcha.
Have you got anything you can share with us that spring to mind?
Well, it's kind of invidious to pick any particular individuals out. I mean, I've known Sir Mark Prescott for a very long time, wonderful counsellor, great source of advice, loyal. And if you're ever in the mire, which I have a very good habit of getting into, you know, he'd say, oh, you come stay here, leave under cover of darkness, nobody know you're here. But there'd be many others, who are friends. I've been very well treated by the big figures in the game in terms of access to them to write pieces, which is always rewarding, because they obviously ring up saying, oh, we need to talk to so-and-so, and he's not really talking to us. And I said, oh, ring him up and sort it. But I like foot soldiers in life. I like ordinary people. I make no difference in a duke and a dustman, to be honest. And it's always been very important to me that I'm like that. And I like the Mickey Mouse trainers, or the ordinary jockeys, or the lasses who do a particular horse, or so and so forth. And they, at every level in racing, people are playing pivotal parts in keeping the whole edifice, or the whole ship, steaming through. For vastly different systems of reward, we all know that. That's slightly better than it was, slightly. But we still ask stable start to stay in Carsies when they're away and feed them stuff that Oliver Twist would have turned down. That's all getting better, but it's still behind the times.
So what is horse racing now? Now, obviously, that is the sort of thing that's in the past that should be in the past. Is there anything, you know, is it still the sport you fell in love with as a youngster?
Yes. But yes, with that caveat of hesitancy. I think jump racing is thriving in terms of popularity, as it never has before. We have had a fantastic cavalcade of great horses, it helps. I think it is thriving as it never has before. But I know intelligent commentators who think it won't be with us in 40, 50 years' time. That it may fall foul of changing public expectations of what sport should be. But things like boxing would have to go first. In a risk-averse society, the spectacle of jump racing may not be as acceptable in 40 years' time as it is now. It has changed radically with the times. Fences are infinitely smaller. Look at Aintree. the use of the whip was improved out of all recognition. I remember the days when a horse was placed in the triumph hurdle having been hit 45 times from the top of the hill. I remember them pre-drainage days at Cheltenham when the ground was invariably vile, coming up, just exhausted horses, coming up weaving with tiredness up the hill, and horses 100 yards behind being belaboured by some lunatic with carpet beaten. So that's gone, and the whip will go. I don't think the whip will be with us in 5 years' time. Steering or no steering, give them wheels. The whip will go. And the whip going might be a help to us as an industry because of public perception. Whether it's right or wrong is not the point. It is the perception that hitting horses is bad, and it doesn't look good.
Now, jump racing's done a lot to try and, you know, make horse welfare better, etc. So do you
huge amount.
Do you think it can ever do enough, though? It's very nature.
Well, you can never eliminate risk to horse or human. Now, I've got great chums around here who can't ride through bad injury. And we know the great case. We see jockeys die, for God's sake. I think a dozen in my lifetime. And maimed or permanently confined to wheelchairs. And it is a fear. And it's horrible when someone you know well gets badly smashed up. I mean, someone like Ruby, who obviously he's a bad shape for a jockey. He's all very long limbs and gets sort of sticky out. He's not like one of those sort of bouncy balls. Remember when he had a ghastly fall at Cheltenham in the autumn a few years ago, and he lost his spleen, which is not the end of the world, you take a pill instead of it. But anyway, I went to see him in hospital, private bit on the top. I went up and there was a sort of nurse there by the reception. I said, "Do you have a spindly, grey-haired, skinny Irishman with a girl's name?" And she said, "If he is the man with the highest pain threshold you've ever met, he's in there." I thought, that'll be the boy. Yeah. But you know, that is a routine. It's another cliche, but it is so illustrative, like many a cliche. Nobody else has a job where two ambulances follow them around at work.
Yeah. So what would you change about racing?
I'd like to change the perception that still hangs around, though in my opinion wrongly, that it is that in certain areas it's a toffs game. I think it is true on the flat, to be honest, and I think some owners and trainers assume roles or give themselves airs and graces of importance that are unfathomable to me. I've seen the time when trainers went from being posh grooms to international figures. Now, that's probably a good thing. Because in the old days, when horses were the province of owner breeders, landowners, old school bankers rather than the villains, thieves and charlatans of today, they were the grand people and the trainers weren't. But the trainers are grand now, sometimes a little too grand. And some of them are completely unhelpful to letting the media, letting them communicate with the public through the media. That annoys them. Hell out of me. I'd like to get rid of this them. I don't like them and us in anything really, and I'd like to get rid of that on the flat. I don't think it is the case so much on over the jumps. It's much more of a nice, sweaty, jostling, sharp-elbowed democracy. Just look at Cheltenham. What did Andrew Marr say when he went and did a program there? As many nose studs as trilbies. Slight exaggeration, but actually a big improvement on 40 years ago.
Now, talking now about racing again, there seems to have been quite a ruthless broom sweeping through the racing post. Is that something that's real, or is it just people coming to
you? It's a ruthless broom. I think the business side has changed. we are becoming much more, we are a betting newspaper, for goodness sake, but more and more a betting newspaper. And that's the way it goes. This is the way it is.
So what plans do you have for the future now?
Well, I stopped being a full-time member of staff in August, and I started freelancing last Saturday from Tingle Creek when Altior won, and I'm going racing for them this weekend. I expect to do four or five pieces a month. And as some sarcastic so-and-so said, how would you cope with the extra workload?
So, any, you've obviously enjoyed every minute, well, it seems that you've enjoyed every minute of your career right from the start. Anything you'd have changed at all thus far?
I wouldn't do it again. Because I go, when somebody important rather than somebody inconsequential, something important, they say, what have you done differently in their career? And they say, I'd have changed nothing. And I think, you unimaginative git. I'd have done something else. I'd like to have taught, been in education, or the law. I think I would have liked the law. And I'd like to have done something else more useful to society, and had my passion as my recreation.
And is there anything you look to be doing now with your extra time that you've got that you haven't?
Try and stay out of the pub is the main priority, because when you've got nothing to do, you think, oh, I'll ring so and so and go and have a glass of sarsaparilla, or I wonder if Tristan Davis is busy. And that's a week off.
So is the pub still a factor?
Yeah, I had 4.5 years off alcohol. I don't drink on the race course if I'm working. And I don't really like drinking on the race course if I'm not, because people then say, oh, you obviously had a bottle of champagne or whatever, and assume that you do nothing at all, or that you're working. I don't like that at all. No. Don't drink in the right schools. I had 4.5 years off in the early part of the century, and I didn't miss it. But then one day I thought, God, I'm bored. I've got it under control 99% of the time, and the other percent I just stay at home and don't go out the door.
The final question, is there a career in horse racing writing for somebody just leaving university now?
No. I've lived through the end of the golden days. Would I encourage anyone to go into it? Yes, but don't expect to have the charter to write that I've had. The space. If you're going to tip horses, be across media platforms, there are endless jobs there, but you asked about writing, the Times has just ceased to have a racing correspondent. When I was young, had two full-time and a full-time Newmarket man and a man in France. Papers give less and less space, printed space, there's reams online, but that can be a scourge for whoever's doing it, because the demands are literally endless. I think the days of having great spreads of words on racing pages and in racing paper, they are coming to an end for obvious reasons.
Okay, on that rather sad note, Alistair Down, thank you very much.
Pleasure.